Moderators drove up right now, where would you be? Up Shit Creek and unable to dream a paddle. The rubbishy part of Hennessy was still rubbishy and pleased to see Ronan getting reamed out, but the rest of her felt bad enough to come to his rescue. Pity, too, she said, leaping to her feet. I needed that ley line. I was just warming up. I was going to bring out Max Ernst's entire cabin in Sedona, with Max Ernst inside it. And a bunch of his art, maybe his wife, too. He built that thing with his own two hands after surviving two wars, did you know? The cabin, I mean, not the wife. I think she was from New York, or maybe she moved there after Ernst died, I don't remember. But I think she was the one who said there was no such thing as a woman artist. There was just an artist. Oh, I was also going to dream that bird thing of his in your honor, Ronan Lynch. He was like you, had that bird alter ego, couldn't tell the difference between birds and humans, lop lop. Hennessy, this isn't, Bride started. She blew on. I knew I'd have the name if I thought about it hard enough. Kept thinking it was Rabbity and it was Lop Lop. Yeah, so the cabin, the studio, the Dadaist. It was going to be my dreaming masterwork, inspired by these dioramas. That's the way a good artist works, isn't it? She takes in the things around her and delivers not a copy, but a response to the world she's absorbed. I behold the supposed West Virginia Museum of Living History with its static figures frozen in staged historical moments, and I raise you real people in actual historical properties. A surrealist in a surrealist piece. Now that's living art. That's what Dadaism is all about. This is the Hennessy Museum. Discounts available for children under 12 and parties over 20. Bride gave her a withering look, but it had worked. All her words had drained him of his. He just shook his head and tossed Ronan's jacket at him. Get your things. It's 3 hours to the nearest ley line. We've got to get going before this one turns the lack of ley into an emergency again. I'm not that damn fragile, Ronan protested. Bride just said, don't forget your bird. After Bride stalked off through the doors, Hennessy held out an arm to help Ronan up from the hay. Must have been a hell of a dream. Oh, fuck off, Ronan said. Fuck off yourself. You're welcome. Ronan shouldered on his jacket. What was it going to be? Your dream. Don't say plop lop. Lop lop, you Neanderthal. Hennessy said she didn't want to talk about the dream. She didn't want to talk about Jordan. She just wanted to keep moving so she didn't have to think about any of it too hard while she was awake. Because when she thought about it, she got sad. And when she got sad, she got angry. And when she got angry, she wanted to kill moderators. And when she wanted to kill moderators, Bride told her to bide her time. She didn't want to bide her time. That's the crankiest I've ever seen him. Maybe he'll get tired of us and piss off to whatever he was doing before. This was a topic she and Ronan had already discussed briefly in whispers when they had moments here and there without Bride. Who was this person they were following? Where had he been before? They knew he'd been infamous when they first met him, that his name was already whispered around black markets. But for what? And how eager was he to get back to it? Ronan rubbed a thumb over the wheel closest to him, pressing his fingers into the etched word Tamquam. This was a thing Hennessy was learning about Ronan Lynch. He always thought he was keeping his secrets by keeping his mouth shut, but he ended up telling them in other ways. He said, but what were you dreaming about, really? A lady never tells, Hennessy said, and it's impolite to ask. Whatever. Jordan. I said whatever, and I said Jordan. If he had pressed her harder, she would have talked about it, and part of her wanted him to. But instead, he just kicked one of the wheels. It occurred to her, in a distant way, that maybe he wanted her to press him about his dream, too. Something must have bothered him enough that he couldn't prevent all these wheels from driving out of his head, after all. But the idea of holding the weight of his drama on top of her own felt like too much. So they just silently assembled themselves. Hennessy got her sword. Ronan got his bird. At the door, he turned to survey what he had done. All those wheels. He was an unusual silhouette with the raven crouched on his shoulder, the sword strapped to his back. Hennessy thought he would have made a fairly good portrait subject if everything about him wasn't supposed to be secret, which made her think about how, in her dream, she'd thought about how Jordan would have thought Pride an appropriate portrait subject. "I wonder what she's up to," Hennessy said. "What she and your brother are up to." Ronan's voice was dry and disappointed as he turned away. "Bet they're having a blast." 4. Jordan felt a little bad about stealing Declan Lynch's car. Not overwhelmingly bad. Not enough to keep her up nights, or rather mornings, since she was a night owl. Not enough that she wished she could go back and do it differently, just enough that sometimes she saw a Volvo of the same make and model and had a vague, niggling sensation of wrongness. The opposite of the Volvo brand. The opposite of the Jordan brand. Really, it was this. A few weeks before, she'd left the oldest and youngest Lynch brothers at a rural Virginian rest stop in the middle of the night, their faces lit up by the taillights as she drove their car away. Matthew, surprised, everything perfectly round, round face, round eyes, round mouth, looking, as ever, much younger than his 17 years, and Declan, unsurprised, arms crossed, mouth a straight line, eyes closing to form an "of course it's always something, isn't it?" expression just as he got too small to see in her rearview mirror. But it was a minor betrayal. Jordan had known Declan was resourceful enough to find another transportation method for the rest of the journey to the barns, and she'd also known the bad guys who tried to kill the brothers earlier weren't in close enough pursuit to put them in any danger in the interim. Probably. That probably was what she felt a little bad about. Gambling with other people's lives was usually more what the Hennessy half of Jordan Hennessy would do. Jordan was the more thoughtful half, usually. Declan Lynch was on her mind now, even though there was no Volvo in sight because of the party invite in her hands. Heavy cardstock, matte black with a bold white cross painted on it. Rounded edges that felt good to press your fingers against. Jordan Hennessy and guest, you are invited. She knew it was a Boudica party. That was their logo, their colors, that painted blunt cross, that black and white. Boudica was a ladies-only crime syndicate that offered protection and marketing in exchange for what looked a lot like luxurious servitude. They'd tried previously to recruit both Jordan and Hennessy, thinking they were talking to a single entity, a pretty, high-class art forger. Neither were interested. Jordan already had enough limits on her movement. Hennessy didn't play well with others. But Boudica had coincidentally texted Jordan the night she, Declan, and Matthew had fled from the banks of the Potomac River. "Opportunity of interest for you in Boston, given circumstances. Please arrange in-person appointment for more information." And then she'd stolen the car to check it out. It was a sort of Hennessy thing to do. She felt, as noted, a little bad about it. But it was done now, and Jordan was by her lonesome, putting on her lipstick in a discolored bathroom mirror. The whole bathroom was a little unpleasant to look at in a way that turned right around to being pleasant in a shabby way. It was nestled in the corner of a generous space in Finway Studios, a grand historical building constructed 100 years earlier to house nearly 50 artists. Old wood floors, 12-foot windows, 14-foot ceilings, vintage radiators slinking along the plaster walls like ribby animals, easels and supplies set up everywhere, speakers that didn't work with Jordan's new burner phone but did with the boombox she found in the closet. It was not meant to be a place to live, and it was entirely possible her couch surfing violated a city code, but the owner, an artist who blew up nude photographs and painted bigger, more colorful boobs on top of them, wasn't the type to be fussed about such things. It was only supposed to be until she found a roommate, anyway. How long did Jordan think she was going to get to do this for? As long as she could. Jordan put on her leather jacket and examined the look in the mirror. She didn't have a lot of choices. She had the clothing she'd fled in, this orange bodice she'd found in a very nice consignment shop in South Boston, and a t-shirt and joggers she'd bought because God knew if this guy came to work in the middle of the night to paint another one of his fucked-up nudes, she wanted to be clothed. And although she'd been doing a little forgery work here and there since arriving in the city, taking deposits, impressing tourists at the holiday fairs with some quick, cheap works, she'd been saving that money. For what? For the future. The future. A foreign concept. Back in D.C., she hadn't had a future. She and all the other girls had an expiration date set by Hennessy. When Hennessy died, it was game over for all of them. As dreams, they'd fall into permanent sleep without their dreamer. Until then, they all shared the same life, Hennessy's life, living as her and as each other. The girls shared this uncertainty every day. Would the dreaming kill Hennessy today? Would the drugs, the cars, the self-hatred? Would today be the day they fell asleep in the middle of the sidewalk? It hung over them every day. It was hard enough to put one's life in another's hands. It was even harder when those hands were as reckless as Hennessy's. Jordan tried to live life to the fullest. What else could she do? Not just wait. But in the end, the girls hadn't fallen asleep unexpectedly. They were killed. Violently. Unnecessarily. The moderators hadn't bothered to find out if any of them was the dreamer before taking them all out. They'd lived like Hennessy, and they died like she was supposed to. Outside, Jordan hugged her too thin jacket around her and put some speed to her feet. The party was in Back Bay, a 10 or 15 minute journey if she hoofed it. As she walked, she looked not at the glowing businesses on the ground floor, but rather up at the apartments and lofts above. No one in Boston seemed to care that you could see them in their offices and homes. They went about their business and expected you to go about yours. It became like a screensaver of activity. Jordan, like all the girls, was a city person, and Boston was a good city for Jordan's kind of art. And it felt good to be in a new place after being stranded for so long in D.C. trying to solve the escalating problem of Hennessy's dreaming. The other girls would have loved it, too. Poor June, Trinity, Brooklyn, Maddox. Poor Octavia, Jay, Alba, Farah. Poor girls who never got futures. Jordan owed it to them to live a life, since they never got a chance. She couldn't control Hennessy's recklessness or the moderator's ruthlessness, but she could control her own fearlessness. She was going to live as big a life as she could for as long as she could. She arrived at the party. Parties were like people. They came in lots of different shapes and sizes. They had different hopes and dreams and fears. Some of them were needy. Others were self-contained and only needed you to have a good time. Some were warm, garrulous. Others were chilly, exclusionary. Jordan could see at once that this party was a very grown-up party, a party that took itself seriously. See and be seen, etc. The venue was small, an after-hours Back Bay art gallery, age knuckling the burnished floors, abstract paintings brightening the walls, provocative sculpture complicating the corners. It was all very nice. One felt smarter to see it, cultured. The partygoers were beautiful, women, all of them. Lovely, dark skin, beautiful blonde curls, freckles pebbled across cheekbones, big rounded hips, pale midriffs, golden shoulder blades, dresses and heels of every color and length and height. Jordan didn't recognize all of them, but she recognized enough to get the gist. CEOs, diplomats, the daughters of presidents and the mothers of drug barons, actresses, musicians, corn cereal heiresses and influencers made good, celebrities too, but you know. Proper celebrities. They didn't point at each other and say, "Look, there's so-and-so." They acted cool, peerish. Boudicca. "What can I get you?" asked the bartender. She had outrageously red hair, ridiculously red hair poured from a bottle or a volcano. Immediately, Jordan's mind began to consider the challenge of how she would paint it. There were plenty of interesting red pigments, but she didn't think they'd do the trick on their own. Probably to achieve that eye-popping red, she'd surround it with a green background. Green added to red dulled it. Green painted beside red made both colors look more like themselves. Red and green were complementary colors on either side of the color wheel. Funny how opposites made each color look brighter. "What do you have that's cheap?" Jordan asked. The bartender looked up through her eyelashes. Her eyes were green. "Open bar for you." Jordan flashed a huge smile. "What do you have that's orange? Do you want sweet or sour?" "Oh, I'm not going to drink it. It's to match my top." The bartender did her best, and Jordan tipped her with some of her precious forgery money and then took her orange top and orange drink to mingle. Fake mingle. Really, she just wanted to information gather. Jordan had crashed enough parties to be good at this, but she was thrown by all the famous faces here. Were these members or clients or both? This felt higher stakes than it had in D.C. Higher stakes, she reminded herself, but same game. She knew how to play it. It was just forgery, after all. Forgery of people rather than art. The key was to remember to be better than a mere copy or mimic. If one painted exactly what one saw, as accurately as possible, the result might be technically correct, but was also stilted, brittle. If one ran into a technical snag in its recreation, the whole process ground to a halt. One had to stick to the script. But with forgery, the surface details were less important than the rules that proved them. Every work of art had rules. Paint was allowed to pool in the corners. Lines were feathery at their ends as the brush was lifted. Mouths were exaggerated for drama. Blacks were unsaturated, so on, so forth. And if one learned enough of them, one could create endless new works based upon those rules and pass them off as creations by the original artist. Humans were the same. They had rules that proved their behavior. Discover the thesis, and you had them. Jordan used this principle to forge a partygoer who had been mingling. Her lips carried a held-over laugh from a funny conversation she'd just left. She let out an audible breath as she stole a quick look at her phone, as if she'd just grabbed a moment between chats to check her business email. She nodded over her shoulder as she walked from a group, subtly suggesting she had just had a good talk. When people tried to catch her eye, she lifted a finger and pointed to a group in another room, indicating, "Catch you in a bit, I'm on my way to a pre-existing condition." In this way, she existed in the party without being of it, gathering information instead of giving it away. Which was how she discovered that these were clients. She wasn't sure what they all thought they were here to purchase, but they were decidedly here with wallets at the ready. What could the spangled company all have in common with each other? What could they possibly have in common with her?
"The Jordan Hennessy."
An older woman had drawn alongside her. She was far more dowdy than the other partygoers, dressed in a houndstooth dress with a hedgehog pin over her right breast. She had a glass of wine in her hand, and she was a little messy in the way people sometimes are when they're drunk, but Jordan could tell she was not drunk. She was just like that.
"Jordan Hennessy, it's been a GD long time."
Jordan peered at her, trying unsuccessfully to place her. She must have met Hennessy or one of the other girls. The woman's face turned cartoonishly worried.
"Oh, you don't remember me. Don't worry, I know some people around here get a little S-H-I-T-T-Y about these things, if you know what I mean. But not me. I'm Barbara Schutt."
She held out her hand to shake, and Jordan was running the scenarios, testing out replies that would work to make her seem reliable, like the real Jordan Hennessy, replies that didn't promise knowledge she didn't have, replies that didn't have trap doors with crocodiles underneath them. They shook. Barbara did that shake with just her fingers, and Jordan said, "Oh, right, D.C., yes?" Barbara wagged her finger at her.
"That's the one. I'm so glad, just so glad you could make it here when I'm sure you haven't even settled in. I'm sure Joe's already touched base with you to talk about apartment options. Joe Fisher?"
"Oh, no, I'd remember a Joe," Jordan said.
"Of course you would," Barbara replied. "Joe is that way. I'll make a note in the little old brainer deck," says she, tapped the rim of her glass against her temple, "to have her add you to the schedule. Don't think we haven't been keeping a good eyeball out for you, though. That little adventure on the Potomac certainly made a lot of people sit up and take notice, didn't it? And we just have been doing our best to make sure none of that notice gives you the time of day here."
Now Jordan felt truly uncomfortable. Had Boudica been keeping menace from her doorstep? Or were they just saying it to pull her into the fold? She needed to say something. Something that kept Barbara from completely having the upper hand. Something Boudica couldn't know about. Think, Jordan.
Jordan smiled broadly and took a risk. "It's nice to have Bride on our side, too, after all this time."
Barbara's smile was fixed in concrete. Bingo. They didn't know a damn thing about Bride, either, except for his power.
"If you will excuse me," Barbara said, tapping a dainty silver watch on her wrist with the bottom of her wine glass, "I should get this rolling. I know you're looking forward to it. So glad you could make it. Don't forget about Joe. She'll be around."
The first time Jordan had been approached by Boudica, it had been a bit of a joke, a bit of a compliment. She and Hennessy and June had sniggered about it over a few drinks and a few tubes of paint in the way they might have snickered over bumbling, unwanted flirtation at a bar. Nice to be wanted, I reckon. As if, dream on. But it was a different feeling now that she was alone in Boston. She'd forgotten that there was a disadvantage to being not one of many Jordan Hennessys, but rather one of one. Vulnerability. Jordan stood there with her orange drink and her orange top, feeling misgiving pile upon misgiving, and then she discovered the music had stopped, and all the partygoers were moving generally toward the back of the building. They murmured and checked watches and eyed each other, and Jordan realized they must all be headed to the real reason for this party. Eventually, after they'd all pressed into a large room in the back, Barbara's voice came over the speaker. Jordan could hear her unamplified voice as well, so she had to be close, but she couldn't see her over the crowd.
"Thanks for coming," said Barbara. "We have a really splendid group here today. You're all really spiffy women. I know we're excited about the events coming up, and we're all excited about... where are my notes? Fisher, you do this."
A petite woman with very good posture and aggressively straightened brunette hair pressed past Jordan and through the crowd toward the front. She was dressed in a cocktail dress that said, "Look at me," and also said, "Now that you're looking, did you notice I think you're stupid?" It was a good dress. She did not say, "Excuse me."
Jordan just had a glimpse of her accepting a wired microphone. Then a voice that matched the cocktail dress came over the speakers. "Everyone here has a dependent in their lives. Some of you know one. Some of you are thinking of introducing one into your lives. Others have inherited one. And some of you are one."
Partygoers glanced around at each other.
Joe Fisher continued. "Boudica is proud to be able to offer a variety of sweet metals in different formats this year. As always, these are available by private arrangement. Demand is high, as sweet metals have been losing their efficacy faster than usual, and many of you are replacing empty ones this year. I trust everyone here's had an opportunity to see that the dependents we've brought in to demonstrate the sweet metals are genuine. Some have asked if these dependents are available. Not at this time. They are for demonstration."
For demonstration.
"Let's bring in a sweet metal." Barbara's voice rose unamplified. "Be nice now. Let everyone get a look."
To Jordan's surprise, people listened. The crowd reassembled, allowing her for the first time to see what they were all pressed close to. The centerpiece of the room was a kid. He was a lovely little thing. A boy of 3 or 4 years old, with fine dark hair, thick eyelashes, a thoughtless pout. He was presented sentimentally in a wing-back chair, which sat directly in the middle of the room. His chest rose and fell. No matter how loud the voices rose around him, he remained asleep. Scattered around him on the bright brocade fabric were a few other objects. Some butterflies lying limp. A soft small rabbit stretched on its side. A pair of shoes. It was clear he was an exhibit like the rest of the art.
"This is very exciting, isn't it?" Barbara said, still shouting without the microphone, sounding like a kindergarten teacher. "It's a really nice sweet metal, a very good one for your home. They're not always good for a living area, but this one is. How lucky are we all? Let's be quiet and look. Here it is." A side door opened.
Two women carried a large framed painting into the room. The subject wasn't very exciting. just a bucolic landscape, dotted with sheep. But the art was nonetheless appealing in some way. It bothered Jordan, actually. She couldn't pinpoint why she found it so appealing. She couldn't stop looking at it. She wanted to get closer, but the crowd and her dignity wouldn't allow it. She glanced at the other partygoers to see their reaction to the painting, but their gazes were all firmly focused on the wing-backed chair in the middle of the room. "Can I put my shoes on?" It was a small, high voice. The boy had half sat up in the chair. With one useful hand, he rubbed his eyes, and with the other he reached for his shoes. He searched for a familiar face among the women looking at him. "Mom? Is it time for shoes?" All around him, the previously still butterflies had taken flight. The little rabbit made a small thud as it jumped from the chair to the floor and made haste. The partygoers drew back to allow it to lope softly into their midst. "Mom," said the boy. As you can see, this particular sweet metal is effective for multiple dependents at a distance of several yards, Fisher said into the microphone. Please inquire for a full list. Barbara made a sweeping gesture with her wine glass, and the attendants carried the painting back to the side door. "Mom," said the boy again, "oh, my shoe." One of the shoes had fallen from the chair. The boy reached for it just as the door closed behind the attendants. The painting was gone. With a little sigh, the boy, too, fell from the chair to the floor beside it. The butterflies dropped from the air around him. One of the partygoers came forward long enough to lay the now sleeping rabbit back in its initial position on the chair. Jordan's heart was an elevator with snapped cables. Dreams. The dependents were dreams, without dreamers. And the sweet metal, the painting that Jordan, a dream, had found strangely alluring, had temporarily woken them. Just like that, Jordan realized Boudica hadn't invited her here because they knew Jordan Hennessy was an art forger. They'd invited her here because they knew Jordan Hennessy was a dreamer. They'd invited her here because they knew Jordan Hennessy would have dreams she wanted to keep awake. The rules of the game had changed. 5. Matthew Lynch woke to the sound of his oldest brother screaming. His brother's old bedroom was down the hall and Matthew's door was shut, but the sound came in clearly anyway. These old houses were full of nooks and crannies. Matthew climbed out of bed saying, "Oof, oof, oof," as the old floorboards chilled the bottoms of his bare feet, and then promptly smashed his head against the slanted ceiling. Declan was still caterwauling. Matthew went down the hall to brush his teeth. The movement of the bristles over his gums and teeth made it sound like Declan's shouts were oscillating, and got a drink of water. Declan's voice sounded higher when Matthew was swallowing and lower when he wasn't, and looked at himself in the mirror. He thought the same thing he had thought every morning for the past several weeks. "I don't look like a dream, do I?" The boy in the mirror was taller than the one who had appeared in the mirror a year ago. When he opened his mouth, he had all the proper teeth. He looked all right. He could be forgiven for having thought he was just like everyone else all this time. But looking all right and being forgiven didn't really change the truth, which was that Matthew was not human. He was just human-shaped. The boy in the mirror frowned. His face didn't look used to frowning. Declan's screams escalated. Right. Matthew shuffled down the hall to his brother's room. The scene was the same as it had been every morning for the past several days. There was a pile of mice, some winged lizard things, a badger with a secretive kind of smile but just around the eyes, a pair of deer the size of cats. A cat the size of a deer, with hands like a person. A collection of birds of varying sizes and shapes, and possibly the most impressive thing, a rough-coated black boar the size of a minivan. All of these creatures were piled on top of Declan's bed, which was where the screaming was coming from. "Declo," Matthew said. Cold. The room was chilly on account of the open window, which was the work of the hand cat. Matthew had accidentally caught it in the act before when he was out walking the hills in a dazed, lost pre-dawn walk. He'd heard a clank and a clatter and looked up to see the hand cat swiftly climbing the gutter to the dormer that led to Declan's room. Without any pause at all, the creature had shimmied the window open. It was both impressive and creepy to watch the hand cat working its little nails under the edge to get it open. Opposable thumbs really were splendid things. Declan's voice was muffled. "Get them out!" He was difficult to see in the bed because he'd made himself a sheet blanket cocoon, the edges sealed against the mattress as much as possible to keep the smaller creatures from burrowing against him. They were not put off, though. The hand cat plucked at the sheet near his face with intense devotion. The cat-sized deer were mewling and pawing, hoofing, at the legs of the bed. The winged lizard things pounced playfully on Declan's feet each time they moved beneath the blanket. "Sometime this century," Declan's voice said, "out!" They were all dreams. Since Declan and Matthew had moved out of the barns, Ronan had apparently dreamt himself quite a menagerie. Although they seemed to have been feeding themselves perfectly adequately while Ronan was gone, they nonetheless quickly decided their morning ritual was to wake Declan for tending. Matthew wouldn't have minded being woken, but they never came to his window. The dream creatures seemed to have somehow divined that Declan was the person least likely to enjoy them and therefore the most desirable to woo. "Come on, guys," Matthew said cheerily. "Let's get some brekkie." "Not you." This was directed toward the minivan-sized boar, which was too big to fit through either door or window. It had come into the room as a noxious-smelling gas, and Matthew had learned that it had to be reduced back to the same form in order to get out. Matthew clapped and shouted in the boar's face, "Come on, come on!" Flinching, the boar backed away but remained persistently solid. Its giant butt smashed into the dresser. Its shoulders swept books from the shelf. Declan's laptop made an ominous crunching sound beneath its hoof. It was getting used to Matthew, which was the problem. Every day it took more and more effort to startle it. "Was that my—" Declan's strangled voice came from beneath the blanket. "I have to do everything myself." He rose abruptly from the bed, sheet wrapped all around him. A ghost. Both Matthew and Boar staggered back in surprise. The boar instantly dispersed into a cloud of noxious-smelling gas, the world's biggest fart. Matthew remained Matthew. "Mary, give me patience," Declan snapped. Flapping his sheet swiftly up and down, he blew the boar gas out the window. One of the dreamt birds pecked curiously at his bare foot with a beak shaped like a screwdriver. He picked it up and threw it out the window after the fading cloud. "Hey," Matthew said. "It's fine. Look, there it goes." Declan slammed the window shut. "Get them out of here. That's it. I'm figuring out a lock today. I'm gluing it shut. I'm putting spikes up there. Out!" "What are you waiting for, Matthew? You're slower every morning. Don't make me write you a chore list." Before all this, Matthew would have laughed this off and then done whatever Declan asked. Now, though, he said, "I don't have to do what you say." Declan didn't even bother to reply. Instead, he began to briskly collect clothing for the day. This annoyed Matthew even more, which combined in a thrilling and toxic way with the feeling Matthew had experienced when looking at himself in the bathroom mirror. He said, "You just threw one of my siblings out the window." The statement was meant for effect, and effect it got. Declan gave Matthew his most Declan of faces. He generally used one of two expressions. The first was bland businessman nodding at what you're saying while waiting for his turn to talk, and the other was reticent father with irritable bowel syndrome realizes he must let his child use the public restroom first. They suited nearly every situation Declan found himself in. This, however, was a third expression.
Exasperated 20-something longs to yell at his brothers because, oh, my God. He rarely used it, but the lack of practice didn't make it any less accomplished or any less pure Declan. I don't have the capacity for your identity crisis this morning, Declan said. I'm trying to get us a car while remaining off the grid and avoiding getting completely screwed by our irresponsible father's associates. So I'd appreciate you penciling it in for a weekend instead. Only recently had Declan actually begun to express his feelings about Neo Lynch out loud, and Matthew didn't like that change either. He said, "You can't tell me how to feel. I don't trust you anymore." Declan got a tie. He applied ties to his person like most people applied underwear. He clearly didn't think himself decent to appear in public without one. "I've already apologized for keeping the truth from you, Matthew. What would you like? Another apology? I can work on crafting one more to your liking in between the rest of my work." "You lied," Matthew said. "It's not just going to be okay." Declan was somehow already fully dressed in full corporate splendor. He studied Matthew for a moment, and his face was serious enough that Matthew wished that it was like old times, that he still thought his older brother had all the answers and could be trusted implicitly. "Go get a sweater. Let's go for a walk and check the mailbox." Proper rebellion, a real Ronin-like rebellion, would have required Matthew to storm off at this request, but Matthew merely sulked off with all the animals following. He fetched his llama hoodie and a box of animal crackers before meeting up with Declan in the mudroom. "You're shoveling that handcat poop out of my room," Declan said serenely to Matthew as he stepped outside. Matthew slammed the door behind him. Outside, it was beautiful. It was always beautiful. The Barnes was located deep in the foothills of Western Virginia, hidden in a protected fold of hill and valley beneath the watchful eye of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Matthew had grown up in the old white farmhouse. He'd rambled over these fields. He had played in the various barns and outbuildings that spread right up to the trees that surrounded the property. Now, the cold mist rose up from the colorless fields and got caught in the dark red-brown lingering leaves of the surrounding oaks. The blue sky soared high overhead. White streaky clouds glowed with morning pink, just like the white painted outbuildings down below. It was really nice, he guessed. For several minutes, he and Declan walked in silence down the long, long driveway. Declan tapped away at his new cell phone in his peculiar Declan way, his thumb on one hand and his pointer finger on the other, glancing up just often enough to keep from walking off the driveway. Matthew threw animal crackers for the trailing dream creatures, careful not to chuck the food at the forever sleeping cattle that dotted the pastures. The cows had been dreamt by his father. Well, by Neo Lynch, since Neil was not really his father. Matthew was father-free, dreamt, just like the cows, and just like them, doomed to an eternity of sleeping forever if something happened to Ronan. When something happened to Ronan, Matthew thought. A sour mood was rising. He didn't have a lot of practice at sour moods. He'd been a happy, feckless kid, pathologically happy. He saw that now. Dreamt to be happy. Matthew had a hard time finding any memory that wasn't full of good cheer. Even if it wasn't a happy time, the youngest Lynch brother appeared in the memory with a plucky grin, like a sun flare in an otherwise dark photo, or maybe like a team mascot posing along with the players, goofy and out of place, but not necessarily unwelcome. Like a pet, he thought. All around him, unseasonable fireflies winked in and out. As Matthew watched them fade in and out, even on this cool fall day, he wondered what kind of dream Ronan had been having to produce them. He wondered what kind of dream Ronan had been having to produce him. His mind kept shouting the truth at him. You are a dream. He hadn't told anyone, but he was terrified of falling asleep forever. He'd already had a taste of it. Every time the ley line faltered, he went all dazed.
enchanted. His feet began to walk. His body began to move. His mind went somewhere else. When he came to, he always found himself in a completely different location, his disobedient body having tried to take him closer to lay energy. As trees took the place of the fields on either side of the driveway, Matthew hurled the entire box of crackers away from himself. The hand cat said, "Meow," in a disturbingly articulate way as it retrieved the box, but then a few little winged weasel things rushed out of the underbrush to fight for it until the cardboard box ripped asunder. Matthew plunged past them, ready for the walk to be over.
"Matthew, stop," Declan called. "I'll go around."
He meant to spare Matthew the security system Ronan had dreamt for the barn since they left, a peculiar, invisible net of dreams that covered the end of the driveway. It not only made the entrance to the barns very difficult to see, it also made you feel terrible if you did try to enter. Anyone who stepped into the net immediately began to relive bad memories. Awful memories. Stuff you thought you'd forgotten and stuff you wished you had. Stuff so wretched that people just gave up and went back the way they'd come. Matthew was sort of drawn to it. Secretly, he frequented the end of the driveway while Declan was occupied in the farmhouse all day on his boring calls on his burner phone, and secretly, he would suck in his breath and plunge into the net of bad memories again and again. He didn't know why.
"Matthew," Declan said. He was cuffing his pants. There was a long way around the security system if one picked through the woods in just the right way, but even the right way snagged one's slacks with brambles. It was a testament to how much Declan wanted to avoid the security system that he'd tromp through the woods instead. Matthew edged toward the end of the driveway.
"I'll get it."
"You are being even more ridiculous than usual."
"BRB," Matthew said. "Matthew, for crying out." Matthew plunged into the security system. The memories hit him like they always did, fresh as when they happened. His brain could not separate them from the truth. This is what he remembered. Losing himself. His thoughts slid into muddy dreaming. He climbed his school's roof. The ground plunged hundreds of feet away. His body was unworried about the height. This is what he remembered. He was mid-sentence with Jacob on the soccer field, and then he was forgetting what he was saying while he was saying it. And then he was watching Jacob wait and wait and wait for him to remember his train of thought as it never returned. This is what he remembered. He was being woken by Declan by the banks of the Potomac River and realizing he'd walked there yet again without knowing it and seeing all the creatures Ronan had dreamt dozing around him and realizing he was like them. He was a dream. He was a dream. This is what he remembered. He was walking, dreaming, walking, sleeping, obeying a power outside himself.
"Matthew,"
a voice said his name. This was the memory that he kept coming back for. Sometimes, when he lost himself, he thought he heard someone calling to him, not in a human voice, not in a dream voice, in a voice, in a language he felt like maybe was his real language. He didn't understand any more than that. So he kept coming back again and again. Then Matthew was through the security system and facing the empty wooded country road and the mailbox on an ordinary chilly day in the present. There was a faded wood cabinet behind the mailbox for the delivery drivers to leave parcels in, but there were no parcels today. Instead, there were a few pieces of junk mail, boring, and an art museum postcard addressed to Declan. Even more boring. Lame. His sour mood remained. He plunged back through the security system. This time it gave him a memory he didn't want at all. There was just him having to leave Aurora behind in Ronan's dreamt forest caves water before it was destroyed. The memory hadn't been bad when it happened, even though Matthew never liked saying goodbye to her. But it was terrible now, because he knew it was the last time he saw her before she died. She wasn't your real mother, Matthew told himself. She wasn't even Declan's real mother. She was just a dreamt copy. But it never made him feel any better. So he was swiping a tear away when he emerged in front of Declan again. This infuriated him, too.
Was that worth it? Declan asked dryly. Matthew handed over the mail.
No groceries. We're out of peanut butter.
There's a man in Orange who I think will sell us a Sentra for cash. Then we'll be able to do some shop.
Declan's voice trailed off as he turned the postcard over. Is it from Ronan? Asked Matthew. It didn't seem very Ronan-y. The postcard featured a painting of a woman dancing with the words, Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, Boston, Massachusetts, printed over it. Declan didn't answer. His cheeks were a little flushed. What is it? Matthew could hear himself sounding a little whingy and was annoyed. Stop being a kid, he told himself. Declan was smiling. He was trying not to, but he was. He had ironed his voice flat, though, so that if one hadn't seen his face, one would think it was just a normal day, normal mail. How do you feel about a trip to Boston? Matthew looked at the dreamt fireflies still winking in and out around them. Ronan's dreams, just like him.
Anywhere's better than here, Matthew said.
Finally, Declan replied. Something we agree on.
6.
What do you feel? Bride asked.
Shitty, Ronan replied.
I said, what? Not how.
Hennessy?
I feel nothing, Hennessy said, except the feel of my arteries closing in anticipation. Smell that grease. I love it.
Bride shut the car door. This isn't going to make you feel better.
It's not going to make me feel worse, Ronan replied.
If life's taught me anything, Hennessy said, it's that you can always feel worse. It had been nearly 24 hours since the three dreamers had left the Museum of Living History. They were parked in front of Benny's Dairy Bar, a decades-old fast food joint located somewhere in West Virginia. The sun burned golden over the worn-down mountains surrounding the town. The dreamers' shadows stretched thin across the faded lot. Ronan was starving. Bride shot an attentive look around at their surroundings as Hennessy shivered and Ronan spat. The sparse parking lot, the decaying town, the quiet road. He was looking for moderators. Moderators were why they were here instead of bedded down on a ley line. They'd barely left the day before when Bride had suddenly ordered Hennessy to send Burrito in a completely different direction. He'd gotten information somehow in the mysterious way he sometimes did that moderators were close. They couldn't risk leading them to their destination. Safer to stay in the invisible car until the coast was clear. Which meant they'd spent the past 24 hours dozing in the car and driving in circles. Get down here, Ronan said to Chainsaw, who had flapped to a nearby tree. Let's get this exercise over with, Bride said. This entire process is merely for demonstration, so I hope you are in an educational frame of mind.
Ding, cried the door as the three dreamers entered Benny's Dairy Bar, where they found booths bolted to the walls, hard tables bolted to the floor, soft locals bolted to seats, thin burgers bolted to hands. Above the counter was a menu board without any pretense or spin. Hamburger, cheeseburger, two patty, three patty, fries, double fry, soft serve one, soft serve two. Behind the counter, employees wore purple Benny's t-shirts. Golden oldies played overhead. Something, something, Mrs. Brown has a lovely daughter, something, something. It had a vague bleach smell which might have otherwise turned Ronan off, but not right then. He instead thought only about the other smell, grease. Salt. Food.
As I stepped in, everyone in the restaurant stared. 6 diners, 2 standing in line at the counter, 1 at the pickup area, a cashier, probably another few employees in the back. Witnesses, that was what they called them. People who would remember a black girl in a crochet crop top and leather, a dude with a shaved head and a raven now back on his shoulder, and a hawk-nosed man with an expression that suggested he'd never felt fear in his life. This was why they never stopped at restaurants. Hennessy held out her hands grandly. "This is a stick-up." Bride sighed heavily and fished one of his dripped silver orbs out of the pocket of his gray jacket. At one of the tables, a teen was already lifting a cell phone to take a video or photo of the newcomers. Bride said very simply, "No." With a gentle flick of his wrist, he tossed the orb. He didn't have many. He said they were expensive, and Ronan believed it. Ronan wouldn't have known the first thing about dreaming them into being. He would have been too afraid to, because they messed with emotions, and they twisted thoughts, and they erased memories, some more permanently than others. Ronan was uneasy dreaming anything that altered free will. The bewildering security system at the barns was the furthest he was willing to go. Bride's orbs, on the other hand, were like dreaming brain surgery. Such sophistication required more control than Ronan felt he had. Pwing! The tossed orb hit the teen's poised cell phone. Both went flying. The phone toward Bride's feet, the orb under a booth. Bride pocketed the fallen cell phone. "Hey," said the teen.
"You can't do that,"
remarked the cashier, but he didn't say anything else because a second later, Bride's orb exploded. A cloud of confusion billowed out from inside it. It began to work on the diners almost immediately. Some gazed at each other in confusion. Some slumped over. The orb wasn't designed to knock people out, but it was hard to predict how people would react to having their thoughts paused and memories flattened out.
"Your balls really are nifty things," Hennessy said. "Love to get my hands on them."
Bride ignored this. "Time is of the essence." But Hennessy pressed on.
"Must have required a lot of practice. Wonder who you were practicing them on."
"Course you could have been practicing them on us, but we wouldn't remember, would we?" He ignored this too. "Do what you have to do, Ronan." Ronan was the one who'd asked him to stop for food, even though he knew it wasn't really allowed under the unspoken rules of their outlaw lifestyle. Food came from the cabinets and fridges of empty houses, places without cameras, places without people. Crackers and canned goods, deli meat and apples. But his hunger had been growing in the car, and now his body was howling that it couldn't last much longer.
"To the fryer," cried Hennessy as she vaulted over the counter. Ronan, however, went straight to the customer who stood motionless at the pickup counter. Not perfectly motionless, not like a statue, but rather like someone who had been walking through a store and just remembered she had forgotten something important back at home. She didn't blink or flinch as Ronan took a grease-spotted bag from one of her hands. He dumped the contents on the counter, unwrapped him, and ate them one after another. A burger, some fries, an apple pie. He was still starving. He took the milkshake from her other hand and drank it too. Strawberry, brain freeze. He finished it anyway, slamming the cup down on the counter as if it were a completed shot. Still starving. A guy at a nearby table had just started to unwrap his cheeseburger. Ronan completed the task for him as the guy blinked off into space. Down the hatch. Then the large fries next to it. Then his date's chicken burger, even though it was disgusting. The pickle she'd abandoned beside it. Still starving. Hennessy's voice rose from the kitchen area.
"If you'd told me before all this that the best food in the world was stolen French fries, I would have laughed in your face, which only goes to show you one doesn't know what one doesn't know."
At the next booth, Ronan ate a melting soft serve, another burger, a salad with an orange, slimy dressing, and raw onions, a paper plate of hash browns, still starving. He hurled the paper plate to the ground, next table. Bride watched him, expressionless. Hennessy's monologue was getting closer.
"I'm rededicating my life to these French fries."
Before this time, I was a sinner, finding pleasure in wine, women, song, and sometimes cocaine and grand theft auto, living moment to moment, not thinking about the consequences of my actions on my own body or others. But now I have seen the light, and I will instead worship at the altar of stolen fries. I will paint murals in their honor. I will rename myself Tuber. Ronan ate chicken nuggets, a hot dog, another milkshake, a barbecue sandwich, a corn dog, and some fried okra.
Can we stop pretending it is food you're wanting now? Bride asked mildly.
Ronan sank into a booth. The food sat inside him, heavy and pointless. Starving.
Bride stood at the end of the booth. What do you feel?
Come on!
You might not be able to feel the ley line, but you can feel what happens to you when you don't have it, Grey Warren. Still, you pretend what you really need right now is a cheeseburger. Look around you. Look at yourself. We're fleeing because of your wheels, and this is where you come. There aren't two of you. Grey Warren, do you even know what it means? Ronan realized this was the teachable moment. This was the reason Bride had used one of his precious orbs to hit up a fast food joint. Ronan didn't know what Grey Warren meant, but he knew it was important. His first dreamt forest, Cabeswater, had called him that. His current force, Lindenmere, call him that. His dead father had somehow known to call him that, and Bride knew this name for him. He didn't know what he was supposed to be learning, so he gazed off at nothing, sullen. Bride tapped Ronan's jaw with a single finger. Protector and guardian, that is what you are supposed to be. King and shepherd both. But look at you. Sick in your avoidant gluttony. There are not two of you. Your waking self cannot ignore what your dreaming self needs because they are the same. Now you tell me, what is it you're really feeling? He pointed at Ronan's ear. Very slowly, Ronan reached up to his ear and pressed a finger into it. When he withdrew it, his fingertip was slicked with a dark ooze. Nightwash. He was not starving for food. He was starving for the ley line. He was starving for dreaming.
Why is it always me? He asked.
Bride said, I just told you.
The night wash came to Ronan far more often than it came to Hennessy. It came when he waited too long between taking something from his dreams, as if to punish him for not doing what he had been built to do. But it also came to him when he was too far from the ley line, as if to punish him for trying to live a life that was built for someone else. Once the ooze started, he had less and less time before he began to feel ill, and presumably less and less time before it eventually would kill him. I'm getting worse, he muttered.
Yes, Bride said.
Why even bother with me then?
Because it is not just you. This mountain city used to be alive with ley energy. Did you see the river we drove beside for dozens of miles, the river the city straddles? It should be flowing with energy. This should be a mountain town of dreamers. But it fades, like the entire world fades. It breathes more and more slowly, and no one is listening to mark the end of its pulse. Few, I suppose. Few are listening. Hennessy asked, Hold up. Don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of kicking ass, taking names, so on and so forth. But if we're all going to bite it eventually because the world's dying, why save anyone from the mods? Is it sport to you? It's not sport to me.
Bride kept standing over Ronan.
What do you feel?
I can't do that, Ronan said. I'll never be able to do that, not while I'm awake.
Don't tell me my business, not while you're bleeding black. I have been at this for so much longer than you.
Bride looked out the big glass windows at the trees at the edge of the parking lot. His eyes narrowed.
His profile prickling that thing inside Ronan. That feeling of serendipity, of knowing, not knowing, knowing, not knowing. And then Bride asked, "Do you two want to know what I was doing before you?" Hennessy and Ronan exchanged a look. "It wasn't dreamers I was saving," Bride said. "It was ley lines." Good, thought Ronan. Deep inside him, he felt a certain peace, even alongside the turmoil of the night watch. Good. This was even better than what he had hoped. Yes, good. Long ago, Ronan had helped to wake the single ley line that ran beneath his forest. He had not known this was what he wanted of Bride until he said it.
"And what were you saving the ley lines from?" Hennessy asked.
Bride laughed. It was a laugh like his smile, contained and cunning.
"Every plugged-in machine, every flat black road, every stacked-up suburb, every humming cell, choked and flattened and drowned and suppressed. Can you imagine a world where you could dream anywhere?"
"God," Hennessy said. Ronan pressed his ear into his shoulder as he felt the night watch trickle down his neck. "Why aren't we doing that?"
"You," Bright answered simply. "It's not a game for the reckless. It's not a game for those who go to sleep and bring everything they see back with them. It is a game that requires control, and right now you two have precious little of it. Look at your face. Feel your guts turning to grime, Ronan? Your game is this. Stop sucking. That is hard enough for you right now."
"Hey," Hennessy said. "I love a good roast, but come on now."
Bride waved a hand. "Why do you think we stopped here? When you two dream, there are consequences for every other dreamer who is living a little too far away from a ley line. Do you think you've killed anyone with your casual dreaming? Do you think you've pulled the ley line out from beneath a dreamer who needed it more than you? Has anyone died in Nightwash because of some plaything you pulled from a dream?"
It was too easy to imagine. All the enormous things Ronan had dreamt over the years. All the living creatures, all the noisy machines, an entire forest. A brother? He couldn't quite bear to think too hard about it. Not now, not with the night watch eating away at him. Guilt was never too far away anyway.
"You can't hide away from the consequences of who you are," Bride said. "Don't laugh at me, Hennessy. How much power do you think it required to pull out all those girls with your face? You cannot do this carelessly. You're not children anymore."
Nightwash trickled out of Ronan's nostril. Hennessy threw her remaining fries back over the counter. They didn't look at each other. "You're right," Ronan said finally. "Now I really do feel shittier."
"Good," Bride replied. "Lesson over." 7. As best the FBI could tell, Nathan Farouk Lane had killed 23 people. The 23 victims had no connection to each other, at least not as far as the investigators had managed to work out. Clarice Match, grocery clerk and single mother. Wes Gerfers, retired dentist and amateur poet. Tim Mistovich, grad student and internet troll, so on, so forth. They were from all different walks of life, different professions, different generations. The only thing they had in common was that they'd all 23 been found with an open pair of scissors somewhere at the crime scene. 23 was a bad number. But it wasn't the worst number, in Carmen Farouk Lane's opinion. This one was the worst, 16. That was the age her brother had been when he'd killed his first victim. He'd been a junior. She'd been a freshman. What had she been doing while he was stalking his first kill? She'd been joining clubs, that's what. Chess club, art club, debate club, economics club, mixed martial arts club, Young Citizens for Abolishing Hunger club. If there was a club at their high school, Carmen Farouk Lane had joined it and was a model member. You have a bizarre fascination with running in packs, Nathan had told her once as they walked to school together. They need you, Carmen. You don't need them. In spring of her freshman year, spring of Nathan's junior year, the school's star quarterback, Jason Mattai, had disappeared. The day after he didn't come to school, the janitor found four pairs of scissors, one at each of the school's main entrances, open like a cross. Later, investigators would try to understand why there had been four at this first murder when there was only one at each of the others. But of all the puzzles surrounding her brother, this one made sense to Farouk Lane. This was his maiden voyage, and he wanted to be sure it was noticed. One pair of scissors for each entrance, just in case. He was 16. Farouk Lane was clueless. She was clueless even though scissors were Nathan's thing. He drew them in his sketchbooks, hung them on his walls and over his bed, hung them over her bed until she made him take them down. They were enough of his thing that she remembered mentioning the presence of the scissors to him as the rumors flew through the school, because she thought he'd find it curious. But no part of her thought Nathan killed Jason Mattai. And definitely no part of her thought, I need to tell someone before he kills 22 others. Later, the murders made the news. The journos tried out several names for the mysterious killer. The Cutter, the Mad Tailor, the Cloth Butcher, the Scissors Killer. None of them stuck. It would have been different if the killer had murdered the victims with scissors, but all of them had been killed by bizarre explosive devices. Farouk Lane knew none of this. She didn't have time to read news like that. She'd gone to college.